No teleconference.
And I'd like to have the members join us at the table here if we can figure out how to seat everyone. Some of our members will be coming in late, so Sharon, could you see if we can get some chairs around the end there and let the members join us?
There's a couple.
Pull one there.
I put two here.
A little earlier this year, we also had the honor of a visit from some of the members from the Yukon Legislative Assembly. And at that time, we just sort of sat around the table and introduced ourselves and explained a little bit about the district we represent. And then heard from the people from the Yukon, and we'd like to hear from you today as well about things that you might want to talk about that will probably be of mutual interest to us. I'll start out by introducing myself. I'm Sam Cotton, and I, along with Representative Herman, chair the House Resources Committee. This is my 11th year in the legislature, and I represent a district, sort of the rural part of Anchorage, which is the outlying area. We cover a large district that has, for instance, 500,000 acres of state park, but the district's about 40,000 people, and there are two members from the House that represent the area.
Good morning, I'm Adelaide Herman. I represent District 26 in the legislature. I'm from Bristol Bay, but I also represent Volusian and Pribilof Islands. In my district, there's over 40 communities, and some ranging in size from about 2,000 all the way down to a few hundred. I've got 10 school districts in the district, several military installations, quite a few parks, refuges and preserves, and I'd like to welcome you here this morning, and I really appreciate the exchange with the Yukon delegation, and I'm sure we'll learn a lot from you, and hope you've learned from us.
Thanks. My name is Dick Schultz. I represent District 17, which is an area that includes the Toke and Eagle and Chicken and Boundary and all that area there. So we have some commonality in the fact that we do share a border there. For many miles, so on the Taylor Highway and coming across through Eagle in that area. So anyway, there's 27 communities and 5 school districts that I represent, and I've had the opportunity to go to White Horse. I used to go to White Horse quite a bit more than I do now, but anyway, there's some common ground there, and we have always enjoyed the relationship and the working relationship that we've had with the Yukon, so we hope that we can always continue in the same manner.
Yeah, I'm John Sund. I'm from the other end of the state. I'm down where in the southeast portion from Ketchikan, and I represent Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg. There's 3 major communities. There's about 20,000 people in my district. There's 2 representatives, primarily fishing and timber. We have a large pulp mill in town and do a lot of timber harvest and a lot of fishing and fish processing, so it's a little bit different from the Northwest Territories. I guess you have a lot more mining. We have some mining in our area, but not very much.
My name is Lyman Hoffman, and I represent the Lower Kuskokwim area. Bethel being the largest community of about 4,000 people, the rest are all 600 and under. And there's 24 villages in my district. And I guess the area that I represent is predominantly Yupik Eskimo people. I'd say in the villages, excluding Bethel, 95% of them are Yupik Eskimos, and they live a primarily subsistence lifestyle.
My name is John Tisselli. I represent about 2,000 people and in 5 communities, Norman Wells, Fort Good Hope, Fort Franklin, a small community called Colville Lake, and Fort Norman, and I represent the area on the map there that you can sort of see one end of Great Bear Lake under the Alaska sign up there. And Norman Wells is a producing oil field, and it's in my constituency. And also the other communities, I guess the main thing is subsistence.
My name is Don Stewart. I'm the Speaker of the Legislative Assembly. My area is Hay River, which is 80 miles from the 60th parallel. It's the terminal of the Great Slave Lake Railroad and the beginning of the Mackenzie Waterways route that serves the Arctic. A lot of freight goes from there to Prudhoe Bay, or did during the original construction of Prudhoe Bay. We are in the flatlands as opposed to the Canadian Shield. The Canadian Shield splits Great Slave Lake. I should have said that we are on the south shore of Great Slave Lake. Yellowknife is on the north shore, to give you a location. Our people basically are involved in the service industries and the freshwater inland fishery, which markets are all in the United States, essentially Chicago and New York.
My name is Lou DiPellup, representing the higher Arctic. My community is seven communities, one military base and two weather stations, and three Eskimo settlements. I've been there for 12 years. Since became a minister a little more than 2 weeks now. And the activities in my area was pretty heavy last 5 years. Now it's slowing down because the fuel, the price went down. Also the zinc, the price went down also. So yeah, the activities have been slowing down last 5 years.
I'm Bruce McLaughlin. I, in the House, I'm the Minister of Health and Social Services. My constituency is next door to Don's on the south side of the Great Slave Lake, and it's basically a one-industry mining community that I represent, and the mine is in the act of shutting down permanently, so I have all sorts of constituency problems right now. So basically, it's a one-industry town. It was the largest producer of lead zinc, I think, in the world up until a few years ago.
That's the Cameco.
Right, yeah.
I'm Eliza Lawrence, representing Tunedah, that means Great Slave East, Great Slave Lake East. And my I have two community and three outpost camp. One is just weather station there. And most the people live there and they make their living off the hunting and trapping and fishing. We're very close to Hay River and Pine Point.
To give you a little further background, Chairman, we are one of the few governments, well, the only government in Canada that runs a consensus type of government. There are no parties. And after the election, those elected appoint their own executive that act as cabinet ministers and as house leader. Now, they're placed and they sit at the pleasure of the House. So Mr. Pudluck was saying that he has just been appointed, means that there was one minister that was not exactly doing as the House wanted him to do, and he was removed. Minister or the Speaker or the Leader can be removed by a vote of no confidence at any time by the House. So they sit at the pleasure. It's an interesting system, and when it comes to democracy, I think it's worthwhile having a pretty good look at how well it would work in a larger house, because we only have 24 members in our house, but it works very well. Believe me, the ministers do as they're requested to do. Just a point of interest.
Good. Good question, and maybe you don't know it. Who's the fellow that pitches softball for the team that, when they come in, they tear everybody up?
From the Northwest Territories?
Yeah. He's from way up north there. I watched the King in East Court, and that guy pitch. The fellow that's from way
up. That might have been a few years ago was Wally Dick. That's a pitcher that we
had. I saw him pitch here just about a year ago.
Oh. Is he from Whitehorse or
no,
somewhere in the territories?
Way up north there, but he comes down to Dawson every year and gets involved in the tournament.
Somebody from
the Whitehorse.
That's Richard.
No, not Richard. But somebody from
Manuza. A good pitcher from Fort Smith, I know.
Yes, out of Florida.
But I've watched the King in East Court pitch, and this guy, I've watched him pitch some pretty significant no-hitters over the years, and he's been clocked in excess of 100 miles an hour.
Might be Floyd Daniels from Fort Smith. I thought somebody from Inuvik more likely, though.
Definitely springtime here, relatively.
What areas does your committee cover in as far as government goes?
We have jurisdiction over the general natural resource issues, fish, oil, timber, mining. This year we've got jurisdiction on energy, hydro projects, for instance.
Both renewable and non-renewable land.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And environment.
Yeah, the Department of Environmental Conservation as well, which is, we, for instance, will hold confirmation hearings on the three commissioners in the natural resources management area, including environmental conservation, fish and game, and natural resources. And we'll also, for instance, we'll have the opportunity, if we choose, to have confirmation hearings on the boards of fish and the board of game, and I'm not sure which other ones we have. Seems like there's a couple more. But the rules that the legislature operates under defines which committees have which jurisdiction, and sometimes there's sort of gray area, or two committees might try to claim jurisdiction over the same issues, and those are usually pretty easily resolved. We do it a little differently than the Senate. The chairman of a committee, any committee in the Senate, seems to be able to stand up and just ask for a piece of legislation to come to his committee, and they do it, regardless of whether the rules require it. I think we're a little more standard operation over here. I have a note from Randy that Randy Phillips, who's been our unofficial honorary Canadian for many years, and he suggests that you may have some interest in discussing things like native land claims. And he's given me a list here, but perhaps you'd like to bring something up that you feel would be most appropriate to have an exchange on. I know that Mr. McLaughlin suggested that his town is about to see Cominco leave, and of course we've got a town up northwest here that Cominco is just about to arrive.
I think it's the same guy we were talking the other day.
Yeah, Ralph Hargreaves.
Ralph Hargreaves has been running the mine in your town, is mm-hmm. now yeah. just moving to Anchorage to set up the Cominco operations at the Red Dog Mine north of Kotzebue, which is, I don't know, Ned, you can point out its way. It's going in right up in that area up there. It's about where the Cominco site is. But I guess just, Mr. Chairman, just in perspective of size, that I was kind of surprised at Randy's comments the other day on the floor that the Northwest Territories is actually three times larger than Alaska. Mm-hmm. And we don't have enough wall space, I guess, on our map to get over there. But you've got, I believe, Bruce, you were saying about 60,000 people. In the whole district, so it just we think we have immense problems of getting from one side of our state to the other, and having 40 of us here to try to relate all of the concerns of the people over the wide distance. But your fish and game management, I guess that's what I, just a concern of how you do it and what it is and how you get along. We have big controversy in our harvesting of our fish and game between subsistence harvest and sport hunters and commercial harvest.
Well, basically, the fish section is still a federal jurisdiction. It is in all of Canada, actually, although the provinces do have been empowered to make regulations with regard to conservation and opening and closing of freshwater lakes and also the quotas to be taken. But the federal government has maintained control over the coastal fisheries. And in our area, have maintained full control over all of the fish. With regard to the game division has been the authority has been delegated to the territorial government to look after the game, and not sure who would be better, best to speak on that. We're really not involved in that section in the area that I come from, but there's a complete division on the two. The two are not together in our area.
So you have a minister of game, just our natural resources?
Renewable resources.
Renewable resources. Copies.
Takes care of all of that.
Yeah. Sea mammals is taken care of by the our federal government. And those animals who live on the land and ice, which that's we call renewable resources. And we're also asking for the federal government to take, we would like to take part of fisheries and sea mammals, but we never come to the agreement yet, but which is, I think in the future we will take that responsibility, because we got more sea mammals in my area, like bullhead, white whale, narwhal, walrus, seals, any other stuff up there, which is we can territorial government can not really doesn't have a control over. But they have some staff in some in areas, but not in our communities.
Do the Mr. Chairman? Do the bowhead whales that come over to you? Do they come around Alaska through the Arctic, or do they come the other direction?
I think they come from the other direction, because there's so much ice between the Alaska and Beaufort and the. And the Baffin. I'm sure they're coming from other tracks, like Lancaster. So,
Chair, go ahead, Doug. Would you have some comments?
Just had a question. What's the population of the Northwest Territory?
Officially 51,000.
51,000. Where do you meet? In Yellowknife?
Yellowknife is the capital. Uh-huh. This year's budget was $800 million. That we just got through passing the other day.
Pretty significant budget for us.
Look at the area.
Yeah.
What's the breakdown as far as the budget? What's the maybe you could give us an example or a breakdown of where the spending takes place?
The biggest is education. Education takes up about a fifth. And education, housing,
economic,
and health and social services are the three biggest, same as your jurisdiction. We also have sort of a hidden fact that we have a Department of Public Works which maintains the buildings for all different departments, and if you divide it down, their cost amongst health, education, social services, that's the biggest part of their budget is maintaining those buildings, so there's sort of there's a little bit of a hidden cost to some of the departments too.
I know we were talking the other day about how the. Did we finish on that big?
Well, I was just going to follow up on that. The population of the Yukon is approximately what? About 60, isn't it?
25,000.
Huh?
25,000.
No.
Yes.
Yeah. It's under 30 anyway.
Yeah.
Got down the Yukon?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Got as low as 22 at one stage.
White horses are what?
About 15,000.
Yeah. Everybody's in White Horse.
Within a stone's throw.
It's something like Alaska with Anchorage.
Okay. What was the Yukon's budget?
180 million.
Okay.
I saw their end of the port.
Now the other question I have really doesn't have.
You see, that's they're on the party system. We see advantages of staying the way we are.
Sounds like it.
The only other question I have is, if a person was going to get an airplane, fly over from Tok to go fishing at Great Slave or Great Bear, which one should he go to? Which one's the best for fishing?
Great Bear Lake.
Three to one in favor of Great Slave.
Are you talking about Arctic?
And all the movie stars go to Great Bear Lake.
That's true. And the mafia.
Seems like your population is centered around Great Slave Lake.
Prince Charles.
It's warm in there.
What now? You mentioned that there was oil production in your, you call them writings, I guess, or your district. But now, who gets the revenues from that? As far as the federal government collects the revenue directly.
Right.
How is that broken down? Like, is there a standard set of, is there a royalty that's shared back with the territory?
They have a different royalty depending upon whether it's oil or minerals, and they have different amounts by pound or ounce, depending upon the whatever type of material is being extracted. But they keep it all. There's no revenue sharing agreement with us on that. We're working on that, but they're reluctant to give it up. And especially when you look at the oil in the Beaufort Sea, they'd be reluctant to give up such a massive, like the Norman Wells pipeline alone, if we taxed it like a province, that would probably pay a third of our budget. So they'd be reluctant to give up all that to become the Kuwait of Canada if they did, as far as population goes.
But the $800 million that you don't collect any taxes then locally, so it's a
we've territorial income tax.
Oh, you do have an
income tax. Collect that's our biggest source of revenue. Plus, we tax liquor, cigarettes, gasoline. We don't have a sales tax though. And then the rest is basically a grant given to us by the federal government to balance what we require for expenditures.
And all the liquor industry is owned by the federal government?
No. There's private distillers, but the federal government puts a federal tax on liquor and territory government. Virtually every province and territory, the government runs a liquor distribution system. They basically make a profit of about 100% markup on the net cost of liquor. So for basically, if the cost of a bottle plus freight, overhead, everything is $7.50, then we'd sell it for about $15.
It's a new potential revenue generator there.
Well, Lyman, Representative Hoffman, used to be the city manager at Bethel, and he was explaining to us the other day that the city used to own the only liquor store in town. Of course, now Bethel's a dry city, they aren't allowed to sell liquor there now, but that was a big money maker, a couple million bucks a year.
Do you have any, I guess maybe that's an issue, I know this is resource committee, but the alcohol issue, do you have a big alcohol problem in Northwest Territories? Or?
Yes, we do, and we have a system whereby they'll vote on by way of plebiscite to whether or not they'll be dry or not. But this swings back and forth, so we've had to put regulations that you can only vote so often because if they vote dry, 6 months later they want to vote again and they go wet and they're back and forth all the time. So, yes, our number one problem probably in the north is liquor.
So you have a lot of villages or towns and communities that are dry then, yeah. Vote to go dry? Mm-hmm.
It ranges from total dry to restrictions to totally wide open. Just depends upon the communities.
I have two in my constituency that are dry.
I guess, so all of the mining activity that takes place and all of the royalties, revenues, and that just go to the federal government, and then you just get money back from the federal government and that, but you get the jobs and the employment or whatever and the income tax off of that economy then goes straight into your treasury.
Right.
So the Cameco mine that's closing down, what ore is it?
Lead zinc.
Zinc?
Lead zinc, yeah. With no trace elements either. It's just lead. There's no silver folding. It's one of the only lead zinc mines in the world that doesn't have other elements with it. They've been operating there since 1963.
Does the federal government provide any substantial services besides
huge travel
the Northwest Territories services that are provided?
Well, right now they're still running the community health nursing stations in all the small communities, which is about $75 million budget a year. We're in the process of negotiating them to transfer that to our responsibility. And they provide the policing service. We pay 57% of the cost, they pay the other. And they police all the communities and through the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Is that mine shutting down because of market?
Basically, the ore reserves are low grade, and instead of being one big huge ore body, it's a whole bunch of small ore bodies, and they've mined all the higher grade ones that are close to the mills. So basically, what you have is low grade material, or it's too far away from the concentrator, or it's too deep, it's too much. Water has to be pumped and too much material has to be removed to get at the ore to make it profitable.
One of the things that we're going to be discussing at some point here is a program that the state of Alaska has. It's called Power Cost Equalization. The theory is that the urban areas, since they're concentrated and for a lot of different reasons, we've got, like for instance in Anchorage, we've got natural gas that we can use to burn in turbines and generate electricity a lot cheaper than most of the generating facilities out in the bush, so there's a subsidy there to try to get the price down a little bit, because most of them use diesel generators. I assume that's probably what generates electricity in most of your areas.
Yeah, and we have actually a federal crown corporation called Northern Canada Power Commission, which serves the Yukon and Northwest Territories, and both the Yukon government and our government have negotiated taking over that responsibility. In fact, April 1st, I believe the Yukon took over responsibility in their jurisdiction. And that's the same thing we have. We have hydropower around the Great Slave Lake in my community and in Yellowknife. And they charge an extremely high percentage profit there, and they use that to subsidize the operation of the diesel communities. They lose money in all the small communities, but they make up for it in the Yellowknife and Pine Point hydro facilities.
What kind of rates do they pay around Great Slave Lake?
Great concept.
Great model.
Diesel generated areas around Great Slave Lake would be about 12 cents a kilowatt.
12 cents.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Sorry. In the other areas, they about on the hydro areas are around 6 cents. However, we found that trying to subsidize power it's a double-edged sword, and you've got to be very, very careful with it. That part of the reason for the closing of Pine Point mines and other mines has been that we were charging up to 120% of the cost of power to these large operations to subsidize power in other areas. Now, this has been given as part of the reason for their closing of the high operation cost as far as electric power is concerned. So when you try and subsidize, you got to be very, very careful how you approach this, because it can be disastrous, and it can cause an awful lot of problems that are not necessarily foreseeable when you're doing it.
I guess when the dam shuts down in the Pine Point area, they're actually charging 130% there of actual cost, and they're going to lose about $12 million a year in revenue, which is probably going to mean a virtual doubling of prices of power in the rest of the territory.
Is it a postage stamp?
I should also explain they have different rates, too. Government in all the communities pays the highest rate of anybody, so it depends on who the consumer is. If it's for example, a government residential staff house, the rate there will be higher than a commercial user who owns a private store in the small diesel community. So basically, government subsidizes the whole power system.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, because there appears at Pine Point there's a requirement that if they have power, they have to buy it from the government. In Alaska here, we allow anybody to generate their own power if they want to. So if there's always a threshold issue, right? If the power from the power company is costing too much and you think you can do it cheaper, you can go out and buy your own diesel generators and your own generator system and put it in and do it yourself. So that kind of takes that, that question there at Pine Point. If they feel power cost was the real reason because they were paying too much, they'd have the option here to go do it themselves.
Well, yeah, but that might appear to be a reasonable assumption, but it really doesn't hold any water at all because they have a mix on power. Most of the power they're using comes from the Tolson system, hydropower, that's relatively cheap. Mm-hmm. But then the mix to meet their peak requirements, they've had to put in some pretty expensive diesel equipment to cover that. Now, they couldn't put that diesel in any cheaper than NCPC did. So relatively speaking, they took the cheapest way,
right.
But it was still too expensive, so they couldn't do it any cheaper. But
they did try to run
on the surface of the thing. They used this as an argument, but when they really put the figures down, because I was on the board of the Northern Canada Power Commission, and we made damn sure that the figure was below what they could do it for, so that they couldn't come back.
Alhide had a question there.
Yeah, a couple questions. Could you tell me is there some kind of movement in Canada by certain groups against the trapping industry? There's quite a bit of trapping in my district, and I've heard that people are trying to get rid of the industry over there. And then the other questions are maybe you could let me know who visits there. Where do you get a lot of your tourists from, and if you have agreements with any. Yukon Territories or whoever. And then Randy had down here something about education exchanges of students and teachers, and I'm wondering, what exactly does that mean? Are you looking to us for that exchange, or is that happening?
Maybe I could just answer the one part on the anti-fur lobby. We were hit twice. Once it was the lobby against the hunting of seals, and that affected our northern Inuit communities where actually adult seals are primarily hunted, but the spin-off effect was devastating for those communities, and now there's also an actually anti-fur trapping lobby started up, and our government, in conjunction with the Hudson's Bay and a few other private companies, and the Aboriginal organizations in the country have started the Canadian Fur Institute more actively promoting the sale of furs and explaining how the industry actually operates and how important it is to the economy. And they visited Europe, and in fact, recently there was a vote in the parliament in Sweden to ban the import of furs, and the members arguing against it used data and information which our Fur Institute had provided them, and the motion was actually defeated, which surprised everybody. But so we're trying to turn it around, but it's a big battle. The Save the Animals Society, basically in Britain, they've got a war chest of money that's incredible. And it's changed now from being a prevention of cruelty to animals organization. These are now animal rights advocates, and these people are against eating chicken eggs. These people are against any use of animals in any way, shape, or form for human benefit. And so we're really exploiting that fact to try to blow them out of the water, because they're against everything. They've taken over the Society for Prevention of Cruelty of Animals in Toronto already. They took it over a long time ago in England. They just took over the Society of Friendship Cruelty to Animals in the City of Toronto.
Did you want to follow up there?
Well, the other questions on tourism and education, I guess.
Well, you were interested in exchanges, education exchanges.
I was just talking about the universities, different area, the one you're talking about yesterday.
We're doing quite an effort here in Alaska on tourism. We spend, what's our budget? Last year, $6 million to...
$8 million
to advertise on TV across the United States, and magazines, and send out colorful brochures, and a lot of other efforts to try to bring people into Alaska as we recognize more and more the great nature of the tourist industry, the clean clean industry that people bring money here.
Well, our government puts out a lot of very good brochures, colored, very expensive brochures. But the tourist industry is left pretty well on its own. They attend these various fairs in various parts of the United States to pick up business to fill their camps during the summer. And so far, things have, they've been holding their own. But the development, the curve is not is not really going up. It's kind of flattened out. Maybe, if anything, a little dropping slightly as far as tourism has been concerned. It's directly, of course, attributed to the economy and the expense of air travel to get into these various places. Now, we haven't been able to do very much with the Yukon and with Alaska. However, there is a section of our highway that... if we could get it completed from Fort Simpson to Inuvik, would then give us a circle type of tour then that could embrace the Yukon, Alaska, and give a complete circle type of automobile caravan route. That there's a lot of good scenery on this new route, and we could really then work very well with the Yukon and Alaska as part of a development of a tourist.
Is there a migration of caribou in that same area?
In some parts.
The porcupine herd that comes through
crosses the dips to Alaska.
Across the area that you're proposing to construct a road.
Right, but there's already the Dempster Highway through the Yukon to the Arctic Coast already goes. Our idea is that you could then drive straight up from Alberta to the Arctic Coast and then come down the Dempster to the Yukon and over. So that right now, if you want to go to the Arctic Coast, you either in Alaska or in the Yukon, you've got to backtrack the whole distance coming out. If we complete this road, you'd be able to go up one way and come down the other way without backtracking.
How would that road be funded? Do you apply for federal funding?
Yeah, federal.
Just a comment on that.
For the third question, we have to bring up two different exchanges of between Canada and Alaska. The one I bring up yesterday is only a small subject, which is about 8, 9, 10 for exchange for my foot 2 weeks. For only culture, you know, just to go and see how they are doing their own culture and what have been changed, what's different between our culture and their culture. It's more like more relationships can be brought up in that area for that student exchange. Short period of exchange, but if you're looking at the other area, like exchange for the universities and so on, so maybe Bruce can explain that a little bit.
Yeah, we're looking into the idea of having our students attend your universities, and we've discussed that with the education people. Our Minister of Education was here a couple of months ago, and that was one of the things he touched on as well. So. We're going to be pursuing that when we get back.
I know I went to the University of Fairbanks, and there were several people from Yukon Territory at the time attending the university.
I just wanted to follow up on that, because I've been talking on that subject for 4 years on the infringement of rights of people in the trapping and hunting, etc. And I'm not happy to see that you folks have got that problem, but I've been trying to instill that in the people's mind in Alaska, that there is a movement underfoot to try to stop those kinds of activities from taking place. And we have addressed pieces of legislation before the resources committee before. And when they get to the governor's desk, in the past they have failed or been vetoed or whatever. But it is a very, very significant and important issue, and something that I believe that, you know, over this 2-year period, that the legislature, this resource committee, would hopefully look at it at bringing up a piece of legislation that will guarantee and ensure the rights of the people to continue to trap and hunt in the state of Alaska. The only other thing I want to bring up was, are you guys going to participate in Expo 88 in Australia?
We're still paying for the last
one. We're still paying for Expo 86. As far as I know, because our pavilion was such an attraction down there, the federal government has requested us to participate in the planning of what goes on down there, because we had a real sort of people-orientated pavilion, and they're interested in that. It was one of those things, you could go in, you could touch furs in the pictures and be involved in the pavilion, and they want to get more of a touch like that into their pavilion, but that's the only involvement I know we're going to have to date.
The reason I bring that up is because I assume that somehow or another that almost all the provinces in Canada will be involved with in a pavilion or whatever, representing each one of their provinces. And it's kind of ironic because we have, to my knowledge, at the present time, we have Hawaii, Washington, Oregon, California, New Mexico, et cetera, and most of the Canadian provinces participating in Expo 88, and Alaska is not participating, and that's a real tragedy as far as I'm concerned.
Looking for a little road trip there?
Junk it. No, but I'm very serious that it's something that in many areas where there's just a different perspective on how they look at these kinds of things and that kind of exposure.
How to be part of the Pacific Rim and not be part of it.
We're going to have to wrap this up here. Representative Menard has joined us. Kurt Menard is from the near Anchorage, South Central Alaska area. And also, Eliza Lawrence, you didn't jump in the conversation here, but if you had anything to add, we'd love to hear from you.
Well, I was just going to say they have some kind of a conference going on right now in Juneau on Northern Fur Barrier Conference, and there's some people are giving presentation from Canada, from Indigenous Survival International, ISI, and it's going on right now this morning, and when I get out of here, I'm going to attend.
There you go. All right.
I have a question that might have been answered. On your educational system in the territory, do you educate the students in the villages, or do you bring them in to a centralized location, or how does that work?
Primarily, we've tried both ways. We tried the residential school system, and that broke down, and we went to establishing up to grade 6. Then we extended it to grade 9.
Yeah, we basically have grade 8 in virtually every community now, and grade 9 in most, and actually grade 10 in most now. Most communities are asking for grade 10. But we still have residential high schools, though, in each region.
Is there a limit on the amount of students? Like, if you just have 10 students in the village, do you still go ahead and have a school?
Yeah. Basically, we have a school in virtually every community, no matter how small it is.
I think probably the big thing in our education system is to follow through, in that we pay for university education completely for graduates from our system to go to paid a living allowance if they're married or allowance and for children if they have children, they're paid for the children they have so that they can continue their education. This amounts to a considerable amount of money in some instances, but the system appears to be working. We're bringing some students who have dropped out back into the educational.
Is there a requirement for them to come back to the Northwest Territories?
We've looked at that, but that type of thing is impractical. People are people, and they're going to go and work and do their thing wherever that may be in their own mind, and to try and bring people back is not practical.
But for students that take out a loan that aren't eligible for a full grant, if they have to take a loan out for each 2 years they work back, 1 year of loan is forgiven. So we've done it that way, but there's no condition that you have to return because you take up the grant.
We have a student loan program here in Alaska where if you come back and live here every year, it's 10% forgiven up to 50%. So if you live here for 5 years after you get your education, you get half of your loan forgiven.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we're allowed to ask a question too.
Please. We still have a bill to take up, but we've got a few more minutes.
Okay. On the fisheries and marine mammals, is it Alaska government have any control over the fisheries and marine mammals? And if it does, what area?
I believe that all marine mammals are still controlled by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And the state's jurisdiction on fisheries extends out 3 miles. And beyond that, from the 3 to 200 miles, it's the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council controls that area. It's an economic zone, as you probably know, that the United States controls. But as far as marine mammals, my understanding is that polar bears and walruses and bowhead whales are all under the U.S. Fish and Wildlife jurisdiction.
Yeah, I just...
is that the
federal government. The federal government controls all marine mammals. We have within three miles, but we do manage like the king crab fishery even though it extends into federal waters off beyond 3 miles, the state runs that.
But the native people do have rights to utilize the marine mammals in Alaska.
Yeah.
And also with the halibut fishery, it's international, as you probably know. Alaska, Canada, Washington, wherever else comes in.
But basically, it splits 3 miles offshore. We run everything inside 3 miles, and the feds run everything outside.
What can you do between the 3 miles and offshore?
Beyond 3 miles?
Yeah.
Or the first 3 miles?
First 3 miles.
Okay, well, the state regulates the fishery there, with some exceptions, as Adelheid points out, with the halibut. But, for instance, the salmon fishery is controlled by the state, and we have a fish board that sets seasons and restrictions on efficiency, basically, is how it's controlled.
But not sea mammals, though.
No, sea mammals.
The federal government runs all that.
Okay. Yes, sir, Joe.
One of the issues that we raised on this trip was about the calving grounds of caribou. And I hear that the Yukon has been here and raised it as a concern, and I think it'd be a concern of our government as well. And because of the porcupine calves in the Yukon, and the time of calving, I know it's probably the most sensitive time of the caribou's life cycle, and the calving grounds are, fortunately or unfortunately, they're in Alaska, and I don't think this is a concern it's a matter of between developers and people that are just environmentalists. I think in the people of the northern Yukon, it's a matter of basically food and trying to manage it somehow. And so I think Alaskan legislators should be aware of that. I think on the whole, on the matter of things like fur bearers, that the issue of fur bearers, the reason that we got more involved in it is because more of our members are from rural areas, and we understand that to trap is an important part of our constituents' concerns, so we get involved in that. I don't know what kind of an issue it is here in Alaska, or how hard it is to convince legislators that it should be an issue. But so that's the way we've been dealing with this. And the issue of the caribou, I think, is something that legislators here have to start facing up to. From my point of view, some people won't agree, but I've been involved in these arguments about numbers, about information, where it's coming from. People say that pipelines don't affect Caribou. I don't believe that. You can take any piece of information and make it say what you want, and that kind of argument is going to happen here. I think that there's parts of the Arctic that have to be left alone, and there's no other way around it. It's either a choice between the wildlife or developing an oil field, and you know, the public ought to know that it's a choice of either one or the other, and let's make up our minds and approach it that way. But I don't think we should be going around to the lower 48 and saying that, you know, we're saving the Alaska wilderness, and on the other hand, we're doing all of these things, or northern Canada or northern Yukon. And that's the, as a person that's been born in North, that's my point of view. I thought I'd bring it up. It's not so much an issue for my area. We get a bit of the porcupine herd, but it's more the member that represents the North, the constituency next to mine, which is Mr. Narasu, and he's from McPherson and Iqaluit, and he was supposed to be with us on this trip, but I had spoken to him before about this issue.
You got lost.
Maybe he's still in Anchorage.
Well, John, the issue of the caribou has been in front of this committee. Several different perspectives have been presented. Obviously, a lot of economic interest in development of the area in question, and also a lot of interest on the part of the people that live there and concern about the caribou, and again, from yourself and from the people from Yukon. And there's you're right, not everybody agrees on this issue. And I'm not sure that this committee has really arrived at a consensus either, although we're at some point attempting to communicate with the federal government what our feelings are, and we've been through a lot of specific discussions about caribou. But we really haven't gotten to a point where we're ready to make a definitive statement quite yet. But we sure appreciate hearing your remarks on that subject. I'm afraid, yes, sir.
I understand you're limited on time. I would like to thank the committee for hearing us this morning, and suggest to you that meetings of this nature, I think, are of great benefit to all concerned, and we would like to see some effort put towards arranging something on a yearly basis that would transpire in the three different districts, the Yukon, Northwest Territories, and Alaska, on a rotation basis, so that we could have more of this type of thing. And we have so much in common, and our experiences should be shared so that we take the advantage of those mistakes we've made and those things that we've done right.
I couldn't agree more. It seems like an initial meeting like this, you sort of get a chance to do the first exchanges and get to know each other a little bit, and it seems like it would be very much worthwhile if you could extend it and do it on a regular basis. I'd love to go to Northwest Territories myself, and I'm sure a lot of other people would as well.
Anytime, you're welcome.
We'll take about 2 or 3 minutes, and we're gonna get to House Bill 111 this morning. Call the meeting back order, please. We've only got about 15 minutes. We do want to try to get the testimony from those people who are here, if not out of town, on House Bill 111. Perhaps we'll be able to move the bill today. I'd ask Tom or Jerome to join us at the table along with Pat Kalin. We've had this bill in front of the committee at least once before, and it appears that now the people from the Division of Land and Water Management and the person who represents the surveyors are in agreement on the legislation. I'd ask Mr. Hawkins to go first.
Mr. Chairman, my name, for the record, is Tom Hawkins. I'm the director of the Division of Land and Water Management in the Department of Natural Resources. The department supports the committee substitute for House Bill 111. Very briefly, survey is a basic infrastructure expense. Monumentation of the state's lands, monumentation of any lands in Alaska, is essential for economic development. The task of survey is monumental. The Bureau of Land Management spends $15 million a year surveying the lands for eventual patenting to the state of Alaska and to the Alaska Village and Regional Corporations. At that rate of expenditure, they expect to complete the job in about 2040. It's about a $700 million task to put the very basic exterior monumentation on the lands that will be conveyed. When the bill, HB 111, was initially introduced, it established a level of quality for Alaska's survey that the department supported, but we didn't believe the state could afford. Primarily, we thought in some circumstances it was important for the commissioner to be able to waive establishment of the rectangular net. During the discussions with the survey community, we were able to reach a compromise on the language in the community substitute, which provides for the necessary flexibility, but also makes clear that that cadastral survey and rectangular monumentation or monumentation of the rectangular net is essential and important for economic development in Alaska. And being conceptually familiar with the bill, but not technically proficient, I've brought with me Jerome Pape, who is the chief cadastral surveyor for the Department of Natural Resources. So if your interest goes to fine detail, we have an expert to provide information.
Our resident expert on survey, Representative Springer, did you have any direction you'd like to offer the committee?
No, if Mr. Hawkins says it's fine with the department, I take his word for it.
Do other members have an interest in the legislation as far as questions? Well, I have to admit that I am not technically proficient on this bill either. And the only problem I have with having to leave the committee is that somebody on the committee has to assume some sort of responsibility for being able to explain it to people. And I'm real happy to see that the parties have come together in agreement on the legislation. So,
Mr. Chairman, it was something of a shotgun marriage, and I think the couple can live happy ever after.
What's the pleasure of the committee on the legislation? Mr. Davidson.
Mr. Chairman, I move this. I move House Bill 111 out of committee with individual recommendations.
I assume that your motion, what you intended to say was to
I move to adopt the CS. Yes, I move to adopt CS House Bill 111 and move it out of committee with individual recommendations.
Your objection? You want to say something now? I think you better be, you want this bill to move. Go ahead.
Obviously, you're ready to move it out of committee, and so I won't bother you about technical details, although I was prepared to explain any technical details.
Do you have something you want to say about the legislation?
Well, I'd have to take about a minute and tell you what we did that's different than the last time.
If you have a problem with the legislation, you'd like to bring our attention.
There's one thing that we discussed, that Tom and I discussed before this meeting started, concerning the effective date. We took the effective date off of the bill, just kind of in haste, wondering whether or not we'd be able to get votes to pass an effective date. Well, I don't think there would be such a problem. And the reason I bring it up is if we don't have an effective date on it, it wouldn't take effect until October of this year. If it had an immediate effective date, DNR would it could get the benefit of getting it for, collecting fees for homestead entries, and people that made homestead entries would be able to get the patent to them with an out-of-parts description now instead of having to hire a surveyor to bust a section. That's going to be a pretty dramatic change for some for an entryman in and out of the parts area.
What's the department's position on the executive date?
We support an immediate effective date.
All right. I'd move that we add Section 8, calling for immediate effective date, and appropriate change to the title. Any objection to that? All right, now we have a CS in front of us that's the result of the motion by Mr. Davidson that includes an immediate effective date.
Mr. Davidson. If I may withdraw the motion for a minute for purposes of a question.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who or what parties would be negatively affected by this? I seem to sense that there might be some people unhappy with an immediate effective date, for example.
Excuse me, I didn't identify myself for the record. I'm Patrick Callan, president of the Alaska Society of Professional Land Surveyors. We don't really care, but originally our effective date was going to be July 1 of 1988, because it's an original form. The bill would have forced the department into making some adjustments to the way they went around going about things. Now, with the compromise that we've worked out, it would appear to be in everybody's benefit to have an immediate effective date. I don't know of anybody who would oppose an immediate effective date.
Mm-hmm. Would this committee, could we expect any kind of pressure being brought to bear or any disgruntled citizens, customers of yours in the private sector?
Send them to me.
No, I don't think we'd have any problem with our customers. There may be a few surveyors themselves who would be bothered by having less business coming their way as a result of the bill. This is not a self-serving bill. It decreases the amount of work that private surveyors would have to do.
Would it have a, Mr. Chair, would it have a tendency to, in that regard then, to reduce competitive situations as regards to the services of surveyors?
I think it would have no effect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move the previous motion again.
Is there objection to moving on to section? Not so. We're adjourned.
See how easy we are. Now what are you going to do on the elf, partner? 55.